You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 19th of January 2013 on Monocle 24.
An Australian magazine with a curious format, a food writer with a boozy new project, an old friend is back in the studio, and a tote full of exciting new editions. Plenty to keep you warm today on edition 21 of The Stack. Also coming up on the program today, we hear from a new generation of French publishers, the editors of Six Mois and Revue 21.
The content of Six Mois is a worldwide content. I can't imagine why a story will interest a French or would not interest a middle-class Indian businessman, by example. Why not?
Plus, we sort through a towering stack of new periodicals with world-renowned photographer Zed Nelson. Zed, what have you brought in with you today?
I've got five magazines today. Colours magazine, which has been around a few years. An unusual one called the Green Soccer Journal, which is specifically about football, which I have no interest in, but it's a great magazine. An art magazine called Elephant. A surfing magazine called Huck. And another small magazine called Apartamento, which is about people's apartments around the world.
Plenty there. All that still to come over the next hour here on edition 21 of The Stack, live from Studio One. Good morning from a very snowy and icy London. I'm Tyler Brulé. It's been a difficult week for media retail in the UK, with a venerable HMV in the hands of administrators and more analysts predicting another year of casualties for old media. Nonsense. If traditional retailers worked harder and focused on innovation as much as efficiencies, they'd be in far ruder health. More on this in a moment, including a few reflections on what's happening in a very buoyant Asia media market, particularly magazines. But first, our guests around the table here in Studio One. Well, as you heard in the setup there, Zed Nelson is with us today. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too, Tyler.
Were you doing much digital capturing over Christmas?
No, I didn't capture anything digital
you
over
didn't.
Christmas.
Well, did you get any nice treats in the way of new lenses or new toys for that camera bag of yours?
No, people don't give me equipment. They stopped doing that years ago. I got an exhibition, though, coming up in the end of, 1st of February, actually.
No gift certificates?
No. Have they gone out of fashion? I haven't had any.
I wanted to ask you, but you're in London most of the holidays. What did Zed Nelson's, and you can go beyond print if you want to. What did your media diet look like as you've been in the city?
What does that really mean? What did I do over Christmas?
What, you want to spend the rest of the show defining what modern media is? Or
I kind of like slightly stood out of it, I think, over Christmas. I didn't go online a lot, and I had a nice time. A good break.
Read anything?
Magazine-wise, yeah. I mean, I've brought a few here, and I did a lot of reading, actually, of actual books, which apparently are on the upsurge again. Real books.
Not off a screen.
No, I still have not fallen in love with reading on screen.
Mm. In any format?
Pretty much, yeah. Even the news I have trouble with. You know, I mean, actually, one of the things I want to talk about was the Guardian Weekly, which, you know, it's been around for a while, but
right. That's
where I get my news from.
Okay. Well, we can talk about that later if you want. I'm also joined by Tim Hayward, one of the creators, collaborators, of course, behind Fire and Knives. Tim's been on the program before. He literally teased us. It was a real print tease as opposed to prick tease last time about his new title, Gin and It. And absolutely, talk us through it. I mean, the format and where the idea came from, as opposed to making people go and listen to the little tease you gave us last time.
Well, it started, I suppose, because as long as we've been doing Fire and Knives, which is about food mainly, people have said, you should do something about drink. You should do something about drink. And I know very little about drink. I drink a lot of it, but it's not my area of expertise. A journalist friend said that it needn't necessarily be about wine, which was my great fear that it would get into that area of sort of vinous snobbery. And I said, okay, well, go off and do it. Give me a list of stuff you'd like to put in it. So we worked together on it very, very quickly, turned it around, and it is about drink and drink culture. And great fun for it, I think.
Now, Katie Hawkins is the editor. Mm-hmm. Does she know something about drink?
Yes, she does. Yes, I don't think she would mind me saying she's a total lush.
Oh, that's good. was this really from just hearing and really responding to listener or well listeners readers needs in that case? Was that where?
Well, no, it was really much more complicated. We've had over the 3 years of Fire and Knives, we've had six really quite serious attempts with sponsors to do to launch a magazine specifically about drink. They've said, we want a Fire and Knives of drink. And I think the point about Fire and Knives was we aimed for it to be very sort of non-exclusive. I suppose trying to debunk a lot of the snobbish myths around food. We didn't want any of that stuff. And so they said, yeah, that's exactly what we want about wine. That's exactly what we want about wine. And then as we got later and later into the meetings, we realized actually all the audience were actually interested in, particularly in the wine area, was the social distinctions around it and the cachet around it, the stuff we were debunking in the magazine. So we simply, after all that time, with all those efforts, were never able to put something together. And it was only when Katie said, well, actually, no, it really can be about cocktails and getting drunk. And a kind of the sort of the fun, riotous, slightly drunk take on booze, that I think it really started to gel as something we could do.
Now, you mentioned a discussion with advertisers and brands that wanted to do things. Is it that subtle that I haven't noticed it, or
there
you,
is
you didn't bring any in?
No, there is no sponsorship in this. I mean, I think probably the drink title will be more interesting to sponsors in future because they have more money to spend on this kind of thing than anybody in the food area.
Right.
I think it's interesting the way that the food magazine market has warped, because there are some very, very big spenders, lots of advertising spend going on, but there are very, very few places for them to put their stuff.
Right.
So magazines like OFM, for example, and their new thing they launched last weekend called Cook, those lap up an enormous amount of advertising spend from the big manufacturers of olive oil spreads and things like that. But that's never going to affect the small magazine market.
Now, I'm not sure if we touched on this last time. Would you also, I don't want to say suffer, but certainly it would be a hurdle for you, as it is with Monocle as well, that Fire and Knives has a global reach, I discovered. I saw it in Japan last week. I mean, it's everywhere. It's an international magazine. So on the food side, I guess you can mention the margarine companies, whatnot. They're going to say, well, look, you've got lots of readers in the States and elsewhere. We only want to sell our margarine in Sainsbury's, so they don't want to throw money at you.
That's exactly it. I think as the market sort of fragments, as it moves out over the globe, we would never have been able to have a global reach 5 years ago, 10 years ago. We've done it through the web. We're unashamed about that. We're in print, but it's as much a web entity as it isn't, even though you can't actually see it on the web. We create our audience through that. And I don't think advertising, and particularly sponsorship, will be able to keep up with that. We have to find other models.
Mm. I mean, Zed, it's been interesting since we launched the program, 20-plus programs at this point. There is this sort of divide between some publishers who say, I couldn't live without the web. It's this is incredible facilitator for awareness. And then people want the print edition. And then I think you've had sort of other views people who say otherwise. It hasn't been great. It's confused things. It's blurred things, etc. Mm. When it comes to your choice, and maybe not just the magazines you brought around today, are you going online to get inspiration to actually find print to put on your bedside table, on your desk, in your bag when you travel, or are you still foraging around a newsstand and word of mouth, etc.?
Yeah, I think newsstands. I mean, I do go online. I'm not a complete sort of like Luddite, and I look at, it's easier looking at images and looking, going to a magazine and looking at sort of quickly looking at stories is fine. But I think if I'm going to sit down and read something and learn, I don't love doing it on screen. Although I was talking to a couple of friends yesterday, and she said most of her friends now read their magazines online. I mean, like, for instance, Dazed and Confused. I would never have thought that would have been an online magazine.
Right.
And she's like, oh, they don't buy it anymore. They all look at it online. And it surprised me.
Who was saying that?
A friend of mine.
Okay.
Do you want me to tell you a bit more about it? No, I mean, it was, I was talking about this coming on the program
and asking. And have a word.
Exactly. Does it disturb you, that news?
No, it is surprising.
I mean, I think it's a combination of people go for the cheap option, don't they?
Yeah.
If it's available online, if you haven't got that much money, people sometimes just do cheap things to save money. So I think it's an element of that. But I also think that people get conditioned and it gets easier to do it. I don't know. Is that something worrying or not? I don't know.
Dim, do you feel that, what are you, about £34 a year? Yeah, £34 a year for the four issues?
Yeah.
Which is, I think, as you know, is a pretty fair deal.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. Because it's, you know, it's a physical object. It's the cost, as Kate points out, and that one of four cocktails. So if you can afford a cocktail every quarter, you can afford a magazine to read about it. That makes, you know, that makes some kind of sense. I don't have a problem with it. But I do think, like, it's like every purchasable object now. I'm a writer, a freelance writer in my day job. I don't have an office. I don't have a place of work. I live online. Now, if I pick up a recommendation for something online, I go out and buy it. I'll order it on the spot if there's a link, or I'll go to the shop to buy it if that's the only place that's applicable.
Yeah.
But that's where it all goes on. And consequently, that's where this, as a sellable object, gets shifted.
Do you have a, you know, whether it's around a boardroom table or it's across a card table, wherever it may be, an active discussion, though, about how far you can, not push it to you know, to really sort of take the mickey, but... You know, do you think, you know, we could probably go to £50 for this, because, you know, £12.50 is also an expensive cocktail in other bars, right?
We have a conversation probably about once a year in a bar. And it's no more than sort of licking your finger and waving it in the air.
Exactly.
But also because we've never intended to make a profit with any of the magazines. That you know, that's not the point. We don't pay our writers. The writers do it because the exposure in a quality publication is really, really worthwhile to them, the way their world operates. I know it's very different for photographers who would not buy that.
Well, I think some writers would say it's difficult for them as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens though with photography. I mean, this magazine here, the Green Soccer Journal, which is actually a lovely produced, you know, designed magazine. They rang me up one day. That's how I know about it. And they asked me to do a shoot. And I'd never heard of it.
You should go into our shop, Zed, because we've had them there since launch.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Well, yeah. I looked at it online quickly. And they said, and we had a long discussion about what I was going to shoot. And then I said, okay, let's talk about the budget. And they kind of seemed really puzzled. And I said, well, what's the fee? And they said, we don't really pay anything. And I was like, oh, what's the budget? And they were like, well, we haven't really got a budget either. And they, you know, it suddenly dawned on me that there were lots of people willing to do things for free. And I've done it over the years as well. But it is, sometimes you think, where do you graduate onto if you do everything for free?
Well, there is no, as far as I mean, this has been a very live story online, just sort of Twitter discussion, et cetera, for the last 2 weeks, because The Guardian has put out this new weekly cooking supplement in which almost all of the content is supplied for free by online food writers and bloggers.
Right.
So they're collecting recipes.
Is that the discussion that's going on? Or is it also a question of provenance as well that, yeah, you know, you have, and I think there's always been the question of sort of, you know, bloggers, et cetera, and you know, what PR companies occasionally, you know, throwing them a check. Has that been also part of the discussion?
Absolutely. You know, they're in the same communities, you know, talking at the moment, you have writers who still have mortgages to pay because they've been doing this since they graduated 30 years ago. They've got you know, two kids in school. How the hell are they going to pay if nobody's paying writers? There's people like me who kind of go across the two sides of it. I've come to this quite late. You know, I had a career in advertising for years, and that paid really well. This pays, frankly, appallingly.
Right.
But equally, in that environment, it's easy for me to say, well, if it's somewhere I really want to be and the exposure's fantastic, then no, I don't get paid.
I don't think if you love doing it and it's...
Well, that's,
you know,
it.
That's
but I think what's happening now is we've got this very, very live conversation about why exactly are we doing this?
Yeah.
What's it for? And because the media have changed so massively, the question about, I actually do this for a living, has become less for a lot of people than, am I doing it for personal fulfillment or exposure or to promote something else in my life that I can actually capitalize or, you know, monetize, I guess.
Would you say that, I mean, Green Soccer Journal is they called you up, but I mean, how much of your work goes through an agent where you just say, you know, and then of course, as soon as it goes to an agent, then they will know, well, someone's going to be paying. What's the balance for you now, Zed?
I mean, people always come through my agency, but they always come for me or for one of the photographers. It's unheard of that they just ring an agency and say, we need a photographer.
No, so if they came, but I'm saying, the question is, if they rang the agent right away, they know they're talking to an agent, there's probably a good chance that someone wants their cut, right?
And
that'll be the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, people call me up and then I refer to them to the agent, and then they realize that they're going to have to pay.
Right.
And some things fall by the wayside and others don't. But there is an increasing amount of people wanting stuff for free. And I'd say a kind of lowering of that kind of commercial money, where I think if it's easy to earn commercial money, you tend to be more lenient with the kind of lower editorial side of it.
That distinction, I think, is definitely blurring rapidly between you know a purely commercial sale and an editorial one. I think the agency model is also becoming extraordinarily questionable. I mean, I have an agent for books. That's terrific because they can take a cut out of that, and it makes some sense to have someone who negotiates. But you simply can't find anybody who can make a screw out of the small TV appearances you might do, or a bit of radio here and there, or even columns. Because that negotiation is done once every 3 years online. There's a couple of emails back and forth between you and the editor. There's no 15%. There's no nothing.
Well, I would love to come back in a moment and talk about the role of free versus paid. Putting ink on paper, how much that validates things, I think is a huge issue. And I've brought the new issue of Popeye from Japan, and what I want to talk about is they've sort of, I think, almost sort of sparking a revolution, sort of two boards versus one, skis versus snowboarding. And there's this incredible thing that's happening in retail in Japan. But before that, why don't we jump across the channel for a little story from France. Six mois and 21 are two French magazines, obviously by their names they share the same publisher. The former has established itself as a cult favorite amongst diehard photographers, despite only being available in France. For those more partial to the written word, 21 is a quarterly devoted to long-form journalism with generous helpings of intelligent comics and photo essays reminiscent of vintage National Geographic. Sounds nice, doesn't it, Seth?
Yeah, it does. I know them as well.
Our reporter, Hannah Godfrey, visited the creators of both titles to discover the secrets behind their success.
For two titles that not only look like books but also have a similar price tag, Six Mois costs €25.5, a little over £21, and 21 comes in at €15.5, just under £12. They have astonishingly healthy circulation figures. Six Mois sells 30,000 copies and 21 50,000. So what's the secret of their rather surprising success? As Patrick de Saint-Exupéry, co-founder of both publications and editor of 21, explains, the idea behind 21 was a simple one: to appeal to people who actually enjoy reading and who don't find the daily grind of ephemeral newspaper journalism very appealing.
The basic idea was to narrate the world. Just go back to the narration. So our idea was just to get some distance from the news and get back to different journalism, the one who is still practiced, but less and less, to go back to the reader. In the media now, we are not speaking to the reader. We are speaking to people who want news, 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 who want to have the latest information. Stories who takes time to realize, to achieve, and give a lot of space to these stories, not to be afraid by giving 10 pages, 20 pages to a story. If there is a need for that, you know, just forget a lot of things about what is said in the media world today. Going back to the reader. But that was very practical. That means going to the bookshop.
Can we talk a bit about the format of 21? Because it's very innovative and it includes drawings and cartoon strips. I've never seen a paper or a magazine that talks about news which uses this sort of format.
Yeah, the central point for 21 is the narration. But you can give a story through text, through pictures, and through graphic report. And we mixed all this universe because it's very rich. It's just rich. Everything what is said in 21 is just the real world. But you have to use different tools. And we decided deliberately to mix this world because it's great. We just find it great.
And the format does seem to work because not only are you making a profit and you seem to be selling a lot of magazines, but since 21 came into existence 5 years ago, when I bought it, there seemed to be quite a few other publications that look quite similar.
The first issue of 21 was in 2008, and at that time we were the only one, and people were a bit surprised of 21. They were speaking on a UFO. We were a UFO in the world they knew. 5 years later, there are 20 publications in France who are looking quite the same of 21. So when we look back, we just make the constat that we open a market, we create a market. We never think, truly speaking, we never thought that we were going to open a market, but factually, well, we did open a market in France.
And you're looking to find a publisher in the English-speaking world?
Yeah, we've got the conviction when working on Simoa that that publication was not a French publication and should not be kept in France, because the content of Simoa is a worldwide content. I can't imagine why a story will interest a French or would not interest a middle-class Indian businessman, by example. Why not? Just open our eyes to the world. Sometimes in Europe, and well, everywhere, we're very close. We've got some very little eyes. And the world now is moving, is changing very fast, very quickly. And Simoa, we think, is a nice answer to these changes. So we're working on an international diffusion of Simoa, yeah?
To learn more about this publication, I spoke to its editor, Marie-Pierre Subtil. She explained to me that Simoa is aimed not at professionals, but rather at the general public, simply at people who like learning about the world through being told stories in pictures.
Simoa was launched thanks to the success of 21. They saw that 21 was a success, and they saw that they could do 21 in picture. So the idea is to tell the 21st century with stories in pictures. There is a production all over the world, and newspapers, magazines don't publish anymore photojournalism. So the idea is to publish about 10 portfolios, journalistic stories in pictures. It's 350 pages without ad, and telling the world with photo.
And looking through Simoa, I mean, so obviously it's mainly made up of photos, but there's quite a lot of text in there. But the text is broken up into small parcels.
Yes, the idea is that when you take 25 pictures, you can tell a story, and we ask the photographer to comment each picture, and then we write captions. And photographers spend a lot of time on the project, so they know the people on the picture, they have anecdotes, they comment the picture with stories that they wouldn't tell in a normal newspaper, because they are not asked about the making of. But the stories they tell about each picture make a story by itself.
And can you just talk me through Simoa? Talk me through the current issue, which has USA New Season on the cover. Tell me something about some of the reportage that you've chosen to publish in the current autumn-winter edition of Simoa.
In the current issue, the cover is United States, so we have three stories linked to the cover. And to describe United States of today, we chose to have three stories, one about the housing crisis, one about the crisis of engagements abroad, and one about the end of industry in United States. And we have three great stories, one by Lauren Greenfield, who is an American photographer, who followed during 3 years a very rich woman who began to build the biggest private house in the United States. And the crisis comes, and at the end, she's selling the house. So it's a story of people who participated to create the crisis and who become victims of the crisis. The second one is about a former Marine who has a post-traumatic disorder. And during 9 months, Craig Walker, who is a staff photographer of the Denver Post, follows this former Marine who is very clever and who can't bear having killed people in Iraq. And the third one is about a small town which was the capital of shoemakers and which now is a ghetto. We are interested only in stories of people. We want to show how people live, and we want to show stories which have a universal meaning. It's really in-depth stories, which says many things about the United States of today.
For Monocle, I'm Hannah Godfrey.
Fascinating listening there, Zed, to the creator of Simoa. You, last time you were here, you brought in the title. And it was interesting, just from one side, you know, she was talking about letting the photographers, you know, put things into context, the investment of time that goes into it, the extended captions that they write, etc. Is that the appeal for you to contributing to something like that?
And yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, they give stories space. They kind of respect them, and Yeah, I mean, it really is a great outlet. It's a lovely magazine.
Do you? I mean, you know, I guess oftentimes as well, if you do a great reportage, you know, you're only, of course, unless you're writing it yourself, but if you're going with, you know, with another writer, but you know, for a photographer, it's usually if you, you know, get asked to be on the contributors page, and you know, you might get sort of a pithy quote to talk about that trip. Is that also part of it too? The idea of almost. And I guess, well, there's two parts to that. I mean, is that the appeal to be able to go and do that? But do you like demystifying images sometimes, talking about the process, especially at a time when, you know, everything, every layer is sort of peeled back and,
right.
and there is almost nothing sort of nuanced?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's about demystifying it. I think in Simoir, it's just about being able to relate your experience and write an article or an extended caption for the image. And not having it separated. Most magazines are kind of steeped in this very old-fashioned tradition of a huge division between words and pictures. And so if you're someone who gets very involved in a story and spends time on it, often the words are already there in your head and it's just a matter of, you know, and putting them down on paper. Mm. Whereas most magazines will not encourage or accept that. So, you know, they have a different kind of outlook.
Do you think, Tim, that we're at the point, the making of culture and trying to explain everything in five different layers, you know, also to get them out across five different media channels, actually, when you come full circle, it's sometimes not so great because, you know, you want to create those images in your own head. I mean, I can sort of think in the same way when we launched this, a lot of people said, well, why don't you put webcams in the studios? Mm. And I think one of the beautiful things about radio is that, you know, everyone should, you know that we're in smoking jackets right now and we're drinking out of, you know, wonderful Bohemian cut crystal.
I think there's something beautiful about going back to the more specific streams that we used to have, because I think it takes. There's something relaxing about the fact that it takes pressure off the consumer. I mean, we're reassembling all those media at our end. Everybody's becoming their own editor,
right?
And that's what the new media have brought us. So when somebody actually says, and it's incredibly rare, unbelievably, when somebody says, actually, you know, I'm actually a tastemaker. I'm a person of taste. Mm. I'm going to assemble this stuff for you. You like me. You trust me as a taste-making brand. Therefore, you will buy or consume this radio show, this magazine, this collection of photographs, this piece in a gallery, something along those lines. And so that's a rare thing. And when you catch it and when you find it, it is absolutely beautiful. You're there and you feel that somebody is in the same, they have some sympathy with you, there's some empathy with you, and then, bang, what they've just brought you is lovely. And the relaxation in that, God, you sit back in whatever is your consuming environment and you just, let it wash over you and it's lovely.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of think back to the good old days, at least in this country, but... Well, I can think of the UK and I can think of Australia as well, but and maybe Australia is even in a better position. But I think about the good old days of Channel 4 in the UK. Mm. And there used to be a time that you could really turn Channel 4 on at 7 o'clock in the evening and there would be an interesting documentary on.
Yeah.
And then it would be followed by, whatever interesting import they brought or something they commissioned. And then there'd be a really good foreign film on as well.
Yeah.
And foreign films have seemingly evaporated from Channel 4,
etc.
But that idea of, it was called great programming, it was good editing.
Yeah.
And
I think BBC 4 still does that quite well in that sort of documentary era. But certainly in supplement, specialist supplement magazines, you do see this incredible arc, which is they'll launch in this quite exciting, quite edited, quite mediated way in something that's really quite punchy and tight and interesting and sort of sexy.
Mm.
And then as it actually goes through its arc, they have to expand it and make it more populist. Dumbing down is an expression I would never, ever use in public. But there has to be a sort of a broadening out to appeal to more advertisers.
Sure.
It is basically the appeal. And it kind of reaches the end of its arc when it's actually loathed by the people who originally liked it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that happens a lot with food publications as well.
Gentlemen, we're going to take a very, very short break. We are talking to Zed Nelson, Tim Hayward. We are going away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
For 1 week every January, the world's bankers and financiers, its presidents and finance ministers, its titans of industry, union leaders and economists all head to Davos, a picturesque town on the banks of a beautiful lake and in the shadow of the snow-capped peaks of the Swiss Alps. And this year, Monocle 24 will be there too, broadcasting live from the World Economic Forum. Next Wednesday and Thursday, The Briefing and Midori House will both come live from Davos. Join us as we keep an eye and an ear on the world economy.
And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We should probably cut to what the program says on the label and actually look at some of the stacks. But I'm going to kick it off with a question. If you just pass me the copy of Popeye over there, which is, we've talked about it a couple of times on the program. Popeye sort of came to life at the same time as The Face. And it's always had this tagline, the magazine for city boys, but not city boys as we know them in the UK. It's not people in pinstripe suits and purple socks and wingtips. It's always been for, I think, those city boys who want to really be on top of trends, knowing what's going on around the world. And the magazine had, it was very sort of in this incredibly sort of trendy territory for a very long time, but then went through this reinvention as a monthly. And and what I was sort of saying earlier and just sort of posing the question about, you know, if you actually pay for something and if you invest in journalism, you can sort of see the depth of what they do in here. Does that matter? Does it sort of matter more? Does it have more relevance because you actually had to commit to it? You had to sort of reach deep into your pocket versus something, on the other side, which is, when people talk about, and this is a theme in my FT column, do a lot of likes actually really count for transactions? Does it actually sort of create a trend? And I think that it's a huge question around boardroom tables right now. I think a big sort of, much written about that recently, but a lot of people saying, their marketing budgets, they just haven't panned out. And so anyway, my point was interesting is in this, within a week when I was in Japan this week, the cover is just Ski Boy, and it's got this wonderful sort of illustration of this gentleman sort of, obviously sort of, jumping off a mogul. But then the entire issue, just in the most sort of clinical detail, as the Japanese do, just celebrates skiing. But it is, where to go skiing, but also where would you go and have, and find a fantastic bakery. And there's a whole chronology of ski fashion and what you need to be wearing this season, et cetera. But what I saw at retail then in Japan, and this is, my little comment about HMV at the top of the show, is that you could just see that, all of a sudden, they're probably going to be like just tons of snowboards now, which are going to be sort of, trashed in Japan. And all of a sudden, because this magazine proclaims it's right to be skiing again, that you'll see this entire shift. But it needs an investment. And I'm just wondering your views on that, that sense of sort of thoroughness and deep research. And deep research costs money.
I think the survivors you're going to see in the print world are those who actually, your news and largely your gossip and style information you can effectively get for free. If you cruise around enough, you will find what people are thinking. And actually, you'll formulate your own opinion around that. And that's probably more valid than being given it by the populist press. Publications where you are actually buying privileged information, Robert Parker's Wine List, for example, is one of those things that people pay a fortune for because they genuinely think they can go out there and buy a case of this stuff before hoi polloi work out that they're supposed to buy it too, and the price goes up. FT is fantastic. The Economist is fantastic because you still buy that magazine as a business person or as an informed internationalist because you are going to get the information in there that you need before everybody else gets it. And in a sense, Popeye, in a very weird way, has got that kind of, I'll fork out however many yen this object is because I'm then going to be ahead of the other guys before they go and buy that skateboard, that snowboard in some populist shop.
So do you reckon that there'll be room for enough titles like that, deep investment, paying for photography, and I know some of the journalists there. I mean, it's a proper operation, kind of in the good old fashioned way. Do we see more of those types of titles getting pushed almost up the slope, as it were?
I think it works if you can charge enough for the object itself.
And in their sense, I guess, drive the trend that advertisers want to be associated with it.
But you also have to look very carefully at how far you let it go out. What are your outlets? Where's this thing going to be? How many copies are you going to print? Are you ever going to reduce the quality of the front of it? And then you have to protect your advertisers and who you're allowing to advertise. This is classic old school stuff, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Vogue's been doing this for years. There are people who will never get an advert in there for very obvious reasons.
Zed, what do you think?
I think there's probably a limit to how many of these kind of magazines can exist. And I think it goes back to what you were saying about TV. You know, the ultimate question is, are people getting sillier and more brainless? Or ultimately, is there a core audience for intelligent, you know, good material? And let's hope and stick with the idea that there is. And I think if magazines do something well and they get identified for that, you know, there's no reason they can't be successful. Mm. But there probably is, unfortunately, a limit to how many successful, expensive magazines you can have.
I wanted to, you've got Green Soccer Journal over there. Mm. Do you want to touch on anything in particular about that issue that you brought in?
No, not really. I think it was just something, for me, it was just this sort of idea that any subject can become interesting if it's done well.
Right.
And I'm not a football fan. And so it was remarkable that I got kind of interested in the magazine.
Did you end up shooting for them?
No, I didn't. Just right. Simply because of the I'm just not going to work for nothing. But good luck to them. I don't have any, you know, ill feeling towards them for that. And maybe one day I'll do something for them. But it's just a very well-designed magazine, and it has a kind of range of quite interesting things in it.
And absolutely huge, huge following. Okay, so we've covered that. What else do you have there maybe on the...
Colours magazine is something I wanted to talk about. It's not new. It's not, you know, but it's still going and it's very good.
And it still continues to do... what it does. I mean, I think everyone remembers the Tibor Kalman years and all of the great things that happened there. Some would argue maybe it went a little bit quiet, but does Colours today look the same as, because I have to admit I haven't picked it up in a while.
It kind of does. And I mean, what's interesting is they've managed for it not to go stale. It's a good outlet for photography, although interestingly, for a photographer working for them, they don't credit anyone except in the back in some tiny kind of print, which is, I think,
gets
frustrating.
Up your nose.
Yeah, it does a little bit. you know, it's a well-produced, it's a good-looking magazine. I've got a feeling that Benetton still pump money into it. You know, I wonder, as an economic model, whether it could survive without a big company behind it.
Yeah, the idea of all of those great media... patrons.
But what I love is that there's corporate money behind it, but they haven't imposed any editorial control over that magazine. And it is, you know, it does brush on very interesting areas. And it's not scared to talk about politics, gun manufacturing, all sorts of things around the world.
And that's a rather horrendous picture of two camel hooves.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the one criticism of it is that they it's slightly sensational at times. Mm. But that issue is the current one. It's about trade.
Yeah.
And it looks at trade. It looks at camel markets in Egypt.
In Egypt, yeah.
It looks at China and the trade in sex toys and the fact that there's a lot of unmarried men. It really takes an interesting angle on a theme every issue. And there's always actually quite thought-provoking stuff in it. That's what I like about it. It gets you actually thinking. And that's very rare for a magazine, I think.
And it's quite amazing. You look at the master of this magazine, too, that they have sort of their global list of collaborators. And so it's, you know, so Patrick Waterhouse, then Comet Bath, James Mollison, the creative consultant, Nairobi, executive editor Cosimo Bizzari, Reggio Emilia, and so it goes, you know, all the way through for the team, which is quite something.
They've got a real network that they pull on.
Yeah.
What else have I got written on my little post-it note?
What if it says here?
There's just some things they've covered.
Pakistan arms, Togo animal parts. Yeah, and I can pass it back to you if you want.
Wow. But what that does for the Benetton brand is astonishing. And actually, there's almost no amount of money would be too much for the fact that it gives a kind of international and political cachet. Mm. This is a brand of woolly sweaters. I mean,
does it make you go and buy a green jumper, though?
No, really? but this is much along the lines in brand terms of, I mean, greenwashing would be a terrible way of saying it. But I mean, this way of giving something more emotional value than it actually has as a clothes brand that's a terrific thing. I mean, there are brand consultancies out there charging millions to give people the kind of advice that will never get them that kind of impact. Mm.
No, it's interesting. Yeah. It is amazing how it has come full circle, and almost I think people forgot about what the Benetton family did, and I guess they're one, you know, and again, when of course there was more money and Bennett was spending much more money, and of course, you know, and they do still advertise and they still have their provocative campaigns. There was almost a much, there was the, let's say the red line was much more defined between all of those things. What they were doing at retail, oh, I saw the controversial ad, oh, and maybe I'll pick up the magazine.
But I mean, for years, the best food magazine in the UK was Waitrose Food Illustrated.
Was it?
Waitrose had worked out basically that...
You sound surprised. Well, because it started as Food Illustrated.
It started as Food Illustrated, yeah. And basically there were food stories that were not specific to what you might want to buy in Waitrose. Mm. And the photography was beautiful and very, very well funded, and it was the best magazine on the shelves, and it happened to have Waitrose's name on it. And they always... I think the logic behind it was probably that actually the kind of people that buy this magazine, they're only going to go one place to buy their chicken and their sausage and everything else, so we might as well not thrust it in their face. And a couple of years ago, they decided actually that instead of going out 10 times a year, it was going to go out monthly. They were going to reduce the price radically, and they were going to, and if it wasn't pulling its weight in terms of actually shifting stuff on the shop floor, then they weren't going to run it. Mm. And they rewrote the magazine to actually be a tie-in to a supermarket,
right?
Because being the best food magazine in the country was not their central core of competence, and it wasn't what they were supposed to be there for. It made total commercial sense, and we lost the best food magazine. With that magazine went a great deal of terrific British food writing, and a lot of good English food photography just went down the pipes.
Now, I mean, none of this, of course, impacts what you do with Fire Knives, if there was a new glossy. Do you feel that almost there needs to be more room on the newsstand? Everyone always talks about, you know, the importance of adjacency, that the strength in numbers. Now, you don't always sit in traditional places, but do you feel that the UK still, you know, aside from what Jamie does and everything else, that there's room for a Food Illustrated again?
I'm not.
Or does the Guardian
I don't think the Guardian's got it with their new thing. I think that's it's a company losing 44 million a year. That's you have to make all of their commercial moves at this stage are on that basis.
Yeah.
This is deck chair rearrangement of the Titanic. Mm. So I don't think that's going to be particularly the future. I'm interested in occasionality for magazines, how people are eventually going to consume them. We don't have coffee tables anymore. I don't think people are going to take the magazine into the kitchen and read the recipes out of it, so we don't want sort of a laminated good housekeeping guide to making good stuff. I don't know where it's actually fitting in, and I do have a feeling that the way we consume it is going to change radically. I'm not sure. I mean, we certainly couldn't run a gourmet here, and I'm not sure Waitrose Food Illustrated would run if they brought it back.
Oh, they can't run it in the States anymore either.
Exactly.
We're just going to go for a little short break. Tim, you've got lots of things in front of you, so we'll rejoin those. You're listening to The Stack. This is Monocle 24.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York, and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand, or any brand for that matter, is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Tim, you've got a couple of things here, and one title which we were talking about during the break just now was this great... little one called Pi, with a headline of failure. It's in a kind of a faded but sort of hot poppy red, or maybe you'd say like it was salmon colored. But
yeah, it's a gorgeous little object, and I'm sort of flicking through it. It's not really typeset in any logical way. Black and white on toilet paper, apparently. I mean, it's very, very absorbent, soft.
Very nice
stuff.
Toilet paper.
Very nice toilet paper. But there's things
or
in it about how not to sink in quicksand. A little tiny
these
smaller
inserts,
format insert,
color
yeah,
inserts,
in
yeah.
color. And there's nothing in this that's not a sort of a web factoid that I've seen in the last few years.
Mm.
Things about composite stuffed animals being sold in Germany, and the legends of Baron Munchausen. And these things are all sort of 50 words long, little squibs. But it's a beautiful object. And I opened it up, and there's what appears to be a post-it note in the front saying, "Hi, Adrian, thanks for your interest in Pi Paper. If you could let us know what your review is." And I can't work out actually whether that's a note to the blokes here at the office, or whether that's part of the magazine. And I love
I think it is for our producer, but it does seem that it was probably just part of the mix.
It might as well be. It's I don't know. We keep coming back to this thing about a magazine works also if it's something we want to buy and have and hold and own. And
does it become, Zed, more about the object? I mean, everyone wants to see work by great photographers, etc. But whether you're doing something on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, quarterly, you know, whatever you're doing, does it, or has it always had to be about being an object or not? Do you think we move more in this territory?
I think it's going more and more that way, isn't it? Ooh. I mean, this is a lovely little object. You were saying you don't know how people read magazines anymore, but where do they, do you think? Like, where do we read magazines? Well, when is it happening?
When we were doing the Fire and Knives, and the reason we stayed with the same format for Gin and It was we looked at all kinds of different sizes and shapes. I've got here the Gourmand, which is just launched, which is a tall, thin format, taller than A4, narrower, and it has a kind of almost like a washdown cover of some kind of amazing plasticky material.
Yeah.
And you look at that and think, I went through a meeting where we talked about making our magazine in a mad shape like that, and it was really exciting. And then I thought, well, where the hell are people ever going to read it? And we boil it out down in a really weird way to either the magazine fits in your loo or on your bedside table or in your bag on the tube. But we don't have coffee tables anymore.
Right.
We don't have magazine stands. And actually, I noticed the other day in the Monocle store, you can buy a magazine stand.
Mm.
And I loved the logic behind that, which is actually we are going to create in people's lives the place in which a magazine will fit. Nobody's done that since the Penguin Donkey in about 1938.
But, you know, it's doing well, I have to say.
And so it should. Yeah. So, because it says that it's stylish to have magazines on show.
Right.
But I don't have a coffee table. I wouldn't have one in my house, which actually puts about 25% of the magazines we got on show today. They're either going to go on my shelf like a collector in some kind of a styrene bag, or they're disposable objects I've got to throw out.
I mean, they're more and more book-like, aren't they? I mean, the Japanese one, Tyler, that you showed us, Popeye, this was actually quite nice to look through it because it suddenly felt like a magazine again.
Right.
You know, it was sort of thinner paper.
It has the rhythm and pacing that many of us would be familiar with.
Yeah, you're not going to feel guilty necessarily about throwing it away at the end of the month.
I would.
I think I'd manage to. But whereas this Appartamento is like another book.
Yeah. Ooh.
This one that you've talked about, Pie, is a small kind of art book.
Mm.
Kind of gift object, that one.
And I actually like them. I'm a bit of a sucker for these sort of matte covers and these sort of art book feels. Yeah. But they do sit around on my table and in a huge growing stack of, you know, magazines. I don't know what to do with them. I'm guilty about throwing them away. Haven't quite got time to read them properly.
You get a lockup somewhere for them.
I've already got one of those too.
I think when people accept it as part of the way that their sort of personal creative process is, I do think that the stimulus object is a really interesting usage occasion. We were going through these mags today and we found Hunter Fashion Magazine.
Mm.
Now, when I finished my training, I was as a fashion photographer, and I thought this was how magazines should look.
Right.
It is a thick, beautiful object with a glossy front cover with a simple picture of a beautiful boy on it, and just hundreds and hundreds of photographs, full page, no words, of lovely people in what are clearly very fashionable clothes you can't actually see.
Mm.
No ads, no words, nothing. It's just, as a young fashion photographer, that was, I would hold that to my chest in bed at night.
Right.
And, you know, this is what one day I will make as a stimulus object. It has nothing to beat it. You know, I would have paid £100 for a copy of that back then.
Really?
Yeah, I could never throw that away. So I don't know, that power. It's all about the usage occasion, and that's a usage occasion I hadn't remembered since college, but God, right, it's powerful.
But it doesn't take me anywhere. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know. It doesn't leave me with anything.
But is that just because it's fashion?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, if I was obsessed by fashion, maybe it would. But like I've said, you know, like this one, Appartamento, I'm not interested in interiors. Mm. Right? They're, you know, magazines about interiors seem to be incredibly popular, and I've never really understood it. And yet, when I flick through this, I sort of, for the first time, think, it's the magazine that's made me interested.
But is that because it's slightly anthropological?
Yes. I mean, it's a little bit more documentary. Ooh. It's more offbeat. There's different types of people in here, from a sort of rapper in New York to a sort of traditional artist in South Africa.
People you want to hang out with.
People I want to hang out with. Yeah. I mean, what it is actually varied and interesting. Mm. That's the truth.
But also I think the other point you've actually just hit on there, which I think is quite fascinating, is there's also it's not actually about age, it's about maturity.
Mm.
As a very young and insecure photographer, that magazine would have been beautiful to me because that's Hunter would have been beautiful to me because that was a guide for me.
Right.
Now I'm older and I'm more at ease with that kind of stuff. Then it no longer feels that kind of power. Whereas what you're saying about Appartamento, now you have that, I guess, a more sort of academic interest in what's going on around you rather than needing it that hard.
Yeah.
Your usage occasion becomes different.
Well, also,
or
there's
your
a
flat
sort of,
looks like crap.
Or your flat looks like crap.
there's a human element. We know if you go and visit someone, if you go to someone's house, it's always interesting to see how they live. Like,
yeah.
That is just something innate. And I went to an art show recently, and it was a guy who had, he's an artist, and he decided to have his private view in his house. And I went there. And it was fascinating looking at his house, much more than his art.
What was there.
And it was extraordinary. And there's an element of that in this book. You know, it invites you into people's houses, but you sort of are seeing it, I guess, warts and all.
I think you raise a really interesting point about how we've moved to the object, and it almost, you yearn then for this traditional pacing of the magazine. I think you've got Frankie in front of you, Tim, which is, this is a special edition, a very, rather pricey, I would say, kind of varnishy fabric they've gone for. But so it's object, but yet it still has the traditional rhythm of a magazine once you get inside it, which I think is actually, it's quite a challenge to be able to pull that off.
I think so. I mean, it's the front cover is appears to have been embroidered, and then it's been raised or embossed, so the embroidery actually feels like embroidery.
Mm.
I mean, it's the nearest thing to a Braille front cover I think I've ever seen. I'm literally stroking it as we speak, and it requires that. I found this absolutely fascinating because it's a magazine that seems to be all about. Well, I couldn't work out what it was all about, really. It says it's design, art, photography, fashion, travel, music, craft, and home life. And mostly, as you have, it appears to be people's lifestyles as they've started up a business sort of making felt slippers or knitting muesli or something along those lines. And then I found a piece right in the middle of it, and this is from Australia, with marvellous sort of Australian directness. There's actually this section which just says, high-flying flunks. Famous people who've sucked before they've succeeded. And it's kind of, the whole of this is about getting out of any kind of established sort of rat racery.
And
what you would then do when you got out.
I met the editor and creative director when I was down in Brisbane, and they drove up from, they drove up from Byron Bay, and it's...
Byron Bay, that's somehow isn't surprising.
and what I think is interesting, though, is it chronicles something very, very different, and I think, and is very reflective of where Australia is in many ways, forging its own way in the world, a different type of confidence, but also you can see that there's this real attraction to sort of startup culture, as you said, as well.
Exactly.
But not done in a worthy...
No. And I do like it. It's very Australian directness about that. And I don't know. I mean, I occasionally go back and teach at art colleges and things like that, and I wonder where all these skills are going to go.
Yeah.
So they're not going to go out into highly paid jobs they did in my generation. And actually, you look at that and you think, this is actually saying if you can make your fashion degree into knitting socks in a Winnebago somewhere, then that's going to work terrifically. That is a future. And again, it's a usage occasion for a young age group. But funnily enough, at the same time, I was shown this one, which is called Mjölk, with a little umlaut over the O, and it says it's from Stockholm, Reykjavik, and Hokkaido.
Yet the creators are in Toronto.
Yet the creators are in Toronto, and it says inside, it's Mjölk is a gallery located in the Junction neighborhood of Toronto, specializing in the pure aesthetic of the North. And I thought, now these guys have actually got the whole felt slipper, making pancakes and hugging your kids.
Yeah.
And this is shamelessly glossy.
Yeah. Yet incredibly tactile and matte as well.
And no, nobody's saying, who flunked out of school.
No,
that's not what this is about at all.
No, and very, very beautifully done. Zed, there's some lovely decorating cues there.
Yeah, I got mixed feelings about that one. Talk about it. I like this Frankie one. Now, there's two things that I've just flicked open and made me like it immediately. There's one that says Misery Chicks. Daniel Evans wonders where all the mouthy, sarcastic 90s girls have gone.
Oh, so true, so true.
Then another one that says, Merrick Hardy on the terror of meeting your partner's friends, clique encounters.
On that note, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. Zed Nelson and Tim Haywood, the lovely Gin and It, your new title, which is absolutely fantastic. Our program was produced by Don Trump and Adrian Craddock. Our studio manager is Chris Fitch. Of course, if you have any comments, drop us into info@monocle.com. Remember, back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. News is coming up in 1 minute and 5 seconds. Have a very good weekend. Goodbye.